Well, first, let me give my greetings from the state of New York. I think I was on the last plane out of New York getting here on Sunday. And unfortunately, I think I'm going to be the last person getting back to New York. I spent about 3.5 hours this morning trying to get my flight because as 15,000 flights were canceled, mine was canceled as well today. So it's a challenge getting back to New York as much as San Francisco is a great city. My topic, we'll be talking about the supply of optometrists, and certainly there's a component of cost in terms of training new eye care practitioners. Just as an aside, the cost factor appears to be everywhere wherever you go. American Airlines was finally able to get me, rather than a nonstop flight back to New York as I took here, a stopover in Dallas and from Dallas to Philadelphia, which is the closest they could get me to. And then they put me through to her to rent the car. And I said, all I need is a car for a couple of hours. My flight gets in about midnight. And I said, I'll take the car from Philadelphia, drive to New York, and drop it off at a Hertz place in New York. And I asked how much was it going to be, and they told me $854. So I said, I don't want to buy the car, I just want to rent it for about eight hours. But nonetheless, there's always a cost factor in terms of doing what you want to do. Supply of optometrists. Back in 1995, the RAND report that was sponsored by the American Academy of Ophthalmology said it was a shortage. Optometry did not participate in that study. They had their own app study, which also predicted that there was an oversupply of optometrists and ophthalmologists, and that was where we stood back in 2000. Since that time, there's been a recognition that there is not a oversupply, but there's a shortage of eye care practitioners. If you take a look at the assumptions back in 2000, they were talking about, in terms of the app study, the assumption was that there will be a constant number of new graduates from School of Optometry. They pegged that at 1,125. Today we know that that's totally off base. There are going to be 1,600 new optometrists that are coming out of the schools, and we're talking about an increase over the assumptions of 45% over the assumptions back in just 2000. Medicine also feels that there's going to be a shortage of physicians in all specialties, and they are planning accordingly. The medical schools, which at one time put a stop in terms of the increasing numbers of medical graduates, has changed posture and now they're increasing it. And the figures that are available shows that there'll be a 30% increase over the levels of just 10 years ago. In terms of optometry, there are a few new programs out, new schools, three schools already are in operation, and they will be graduating their first graduates soon. Massachusetts, which is just, I think maybe 85 miles from the present school in Boston, has also will begin operations this coming fall. The numbers of graduates, the enrollments are going up. Enrollments for optometry school is up 16%. There are many questions that have to be addressed with these new schools that are opening up, and I just heard recently there are discussions about six new other schools that might be opening up in the coming years. Should we, as a country, as a profession, put our resources in terms of opening up new schools? Or should we consider increasing the enrollment in existing schools? The profession is concerned. If you talk to the rank and file, they feel that there is certainly enough eye care practitioners. New schools is going to just increase the numbers, and we'll have an oversaturation of eye care practitioners. There's a question in terms of when you add new schools, new graduates, where are they going to practice? Are they going to go into the areas which have a shortage, really? Or are they going to go into the areas where we have adequate supplies? What is ophthalmology doing right now in terms of the numbers of ophthalmologists? Will standards of care be adversely affected because we're increasing the numbers of enrollment? I have questions in terms of the schools that are going to be opening, in terms of the locations. You have to have the right patient base to teach your new students. You have to have faculty who will be within the vicinity of the school to train those students. Many of these questions have not been addressed by the profession. I doubt whether or not they've been addressed by the schools that have indicated that they're opening up. As an aside, a number of years ago, I got a call from the new school in Houston, in San Antonio. The chancellor called me up and he asked me, do we have too many or too few optometrists in Texas? And I'd asked him, well, have you called the Texas Optometric Association? And he said, no. I said, well, have you spoken to the school in Houston to find out what they know? And he said, no. I said, well, why are you calling me in New York? Well, he says, well, you've been doing studies in terms of workforce and the numbers of optometrists. I said, but these people are in your backyard. You really should be touching base with them to determine whether or not there's a need for another school in the state of Texas. But the truth is that decision was already made. The school wanted to have the university, wanted to have a school of optometry in addition to the other allied health professions, and they really were not looking at the supply, the existing supply, and whether that was a need for more optometrists in the state of Texas. Well, in New York, not that we do things better, but we do things sometimes better. And we were exploring the issue in terms of how many eye care practitioners are needed in the state of New York. And certainly there are many factors in terms of the supply, looking at the numbers of optometrists, looking at the numbers of ophthalmologists, looking at the demand, looking at the population, looking at the effects of healthcare reform, the numbers, increasing numbers of people who have insurance, Medicaid, and we try to determine whether or not we are in fact doing a good job in terms of providing for an adequate supply of eye care practitioners for the state of New York. Well, we looked at national enrollment figures. We know today that unlike the App study where they were looking at 1,125 new graduates, that number is really off base. The numbers have increased substantially, and enrollment increased from 5,400 in year 2000, and right now we're approaching 5,900. The numbers of graduates, which was constant in the past at 1,300, is now increasing to 1,600. So the numbers are increasing substantially over the past 2 years. Enrollment increased 10%, almost 10% each of those 2 years. So the numbers nationally are going to increase substantially over the next few years. The problems that we know in terms of workforce studies is that very often when you need doctors, they're not there. Rural areas, inner city areas, are places where many practitioners are reluctant to begin a practice. And this is something which is not just in terms of optometry. We see it in terms of medicine, as well as all the other healthcare professions, where we have to design strategies in terms of enticing and encouraging new health professionals to open up shop in these shortage areas. At SUNY, the State College of Optometry of New York, we engaged in a workforce study to look at the supply for the state of New York. We are a state institution. We have a responsibility to the state of New York for their funding. We have a responsibility to the citizens of the state, and we wanted to take a look at what impact we have had over the past decade and whether or not we are producing an adequate supply for the years to come. Well, there is data from the New York State Department of Education, which is very similar to most other states, where the division that's responsible for issuing licenses have the numbers of practitioners. And in the year 2010, New York State said there are 3,049 optometrists. There were 156 new licensees that year. We know that at SUNY we graduated 71 students, about half of them stay in New York State. And we were able to get what was believed to be the current supply. Well, I don't believe those figures. I tried to determine whether or not that 3,049 figure is an accurate supply. We did a study. We had a 90% response rate. So we really contacted by email, by phone, personal contacts, virtually 90% of all those who are licensed in the New York State area. 560 were practicing in other states. We whittled down that 3,000. We found that others were deceased. They were no longer practicing optometry. And ultimately, we found that there was about 2,100 optometrists in the state of New York, far from the 3,000 that was reported by the New York State Education Forum. Well, optometry is only one side of the coin. We wanted to take a look at the numbers of ophthalmologists. And there is the American Board of Medical Specialists. They have their directory in terms of ophthalmologists. They had about 1,792 ophthalmologists. What we did is we tried to use those numbers. We checked those against the New York State Education Department's data bank to see whether or not these practitioners were still licensed and registered with the state, and we found that there were several hundred that were no longer registered, which means they were not practicing. One of the things which we didn't do in that phase was actually contact the doctors to find out those who were registered, if they were in fact active or not, and we're doing that as we speak today. We know SUNY's graduates, about 60% come from New York State and practice in New York State. We know that there's attrition each year, so even though we found that there were about 130 new licensees in the state each year, since people are retiring, people are moving, there was only a 43 new optometrists who were added to the pool. So we were just barely keeping pace with the supply over the years. I think it was, 1% or 1.3% of the current supply from 10 years ago. Well, SUNY has 75 students in each class. We have a number of PhD and ODMS students. And we do know that of all our students, all of our graduates, about 50% stay in the state of New York and others go out. As a matter of fact, if you take a look at just the new students where they're coming from, I would venture to say maybe 30% come from the state of California, which was always surprising to me that you have so many schools here in California and they're coming to New York. That must be for the bagels and the pizza that we're known for. In any case, we try to add other things into the equation, looking at the demand for health services, looking at the prevalence and incidence of eye disease, because that will, in fact, play a role in terms of the need for more eye care practitioners. Looking just at the age composition of the population, year 2010, 13.6 were over the age of 65. That's going up to over 19% in the year 2030, which is really around the corner. So we're going to have a larger aged population. We know that those who are older have a higher prevalence and incidence of ocular disease. Also, telling us that we need more eye doctors who care for those patients. We also looked at the comparison of demographic data from New York to the United States. And again, we do have a slightly larger elderly population for the state of New York. New York State has traditionally been very liberal in terms of their Medicaid program. The impact in terms of healthcare reform is going to play a major role in terms of increasing the numbers of individuals who do not have healthcare insurance today, and with the advent of a healthcare reform, those individuals will be getting insurance, and we know that there is a direct correlation between those who have insurance and utilization. So of the 1,100,000 people who are currently uninsured, we do feel, and this is data from New York State, they did a survey, and they believe that a significant number of those people will in fact have health coverage under healthcare reform. Just to let you know, in New York City, about 35% have Medicaid. Those numbers are going to go increase as a result of healthcare reform. Well, we decided that we have an obligation to the university, we have an obligation to ourselves and to the citizens of the state of New York. We wanted to have a roadmap to determine whether or not we are doing an adequate job in terms of producing the numbers that we need for our population. Well, from the New York State Workforce study that we did, we developed ratios for all the boroughs or the counties of New York State, as well as the state as a whole. We have about 62 counties in the state of New York. And we determined that there are some areas that have no optometrists whatsoever, no ophthalmologists. There were 14 counties that had no ophthalmologists whatsoever. 11 of those counties do have optometrists, but still there are 3 counties that do not have anything. But to take a look at the disparity in terms of the ratios of eye care practitioners for each county, and I'm looking at only those counties that have at least one type of eye care practitioner, it ranges from 1 to 4,000 population to one optometrist per 38,000 population. So there is a problem, especially in the inner city areas of New York, especially in upstate New York and the rural communities. Ophthalmology. Now, this is data that was not developed by us. It was developed by the Albany, New York Workforce Group. They determined that the numbers of ophthalmologists in New York State will decrease by 19% by year 2030. Moreover, they determined that the demand for eye care services will increase by 23%. They also determined that a large percentage of ophthalmologists have no intention of providing or staying in terms of general ophthalmological care. They are going to specialty care in ophthalmology. They're taking fellowships. So their intent is not to provide to the general public in terms of routine care or general medical eye care. They want to specialize. What was also surprising is 40% of those ophthalmologists have no intentions of staying in the New York State area. Again, the numbers of ophthalmologists are dropping. The need is increasing. We decided in terms of our enrollment, which has been stable over the past couple of years, that we really should be increasing in enrollment. We have increased it this past fall from 75 to 88. And we probably will be increasing it further over the next 2-3 years to about 100 optometrists because, like I said before, we are just barely maintaining the numbers, the supply that we had over the past 10 years. We recognize that students have to have incentives or have to be socialized to the communities that need care. We just set up a center for career development, and it is our intent to send our students to some rural communities while they're still training to understand, and perhaps it may change their perspective, and once they graduate, they may in fact practice in those rural communities. Increasing our class size from 75 to 88 to 100 is far less costly than opening up a new school. Increasing enrollment in optometry is far less than it is in terms of the cost of training ophthalmology residents. So here's another issue that both professions have to look at and address. So it is our intent that we look at the supply, the demand, not just in New York State, but in all states. There's issues in terms of the scope of practice. There has been a study in terms of the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation looking at the nursing profession in terms of how that impacts in terms of medicine. If you allow them to provide the scope of care that they've been trained to, there's no need to increase the numbers of physicians. Similarly, in terms of optometry, and I say this because in New York State, we are still fighting the medical profession to enable us to use orals. But if you enable a profession to use the, and provide care to the scope that they've been trained, then that certainly will impact in terms of the numbers. So, in conclusion, it was our intent to look at supply, the demand. We feel that we have to increase the numbers of optometrists in this state. Certainly there are other avenues that should be explored. The geographic disparities have to be assessed to make sure that new graduates, be it optometrists, be it ophthalmologists, practice in those areas that they are needed for. We do know that we have to look at just not only optometrists, but ophthalmologists. And as I mentioned to you, the numbers of ophthalmologists is decreasing in the state, and we have to fill that void. So what's next is something that every state, every region has to explore, and perhaps the American Public Health Association may want to open its own school of optometry to help the supply of eye care practitioners. Thank you.
All right, we have four very different presentations, and we've got plenty of time for questions and answers, so don't forget what the first speaker said, and maybe we can just begin to entertain questions then from the audience. Yes?
I've got two questions for Dr. Sroffen. Your Department of Education data, is that what I would parallel to my state board?
No, the state board is different. This is compiled by the state of New York in terms of the numbers of licenses that are supposed to be active in the state of New York. So every year when you have another new 100 people who apply, they're added to the pool. The problem with the state data is they really don't weed out people who have moved out of the state, who never practiced in the state, or even died. And when you renew your license, for several years, 3 years. So any data that is after that first year is already outdated.
Same question would be, why do you think the reasoning behind the decrease in ophthalmologists in New York?
Well, historically, you have to understand that when the RAND study came out, indicated that there was an oversupply. So all the residencies started cutting out the numbers. It takes really 2 decades to catch up in terms of reversing the trend. Also, there have been several hospitals that have closed down in New York State over the past couple of years. Just 2 years ago, St. Vincent's closed down, and that hospital had a residency program, and that residency program folded as a result. There's also the issue in terms of the cost of practice, especially in New York City. and that's why I'm not surprised where many physicians are thinking where they should practice, which would be cost effective for them, rather than practicing where the malpractice rates are far higher and the cost of living as well as the cost of practice.
Yes.
I have a question for the first presenter. So, I must confess that I work on healthy people as well from the NIH. I'm actually from the Hearing Institute.
Oh, wonderful.
And she is my coordinator for the hearing aspects as well. My question is, you flashed up a figure of 21 million self-report with vision impairment. And I know the figure that we get from the Health Interview Survey for hearing impairment is more like 35 million. And I just wondered, how have you compared, for example, the NHANES exams and the definitions that someone else put up for worse than 20/40 in the better eye versus the self-report that you get from the Health Interview Survey? And if so, are they comparable or do you know?
No, we didn't do any comparison between NHANES and HS. And HS actually not only our branch, but also Health US reports. They publish every year number of people with visual impairment based on this question, do you have any trouble seeing even when you are wearing glasses contact lenses? This question is not ideal because, first of all, people may be like underestimate or overestimate their visual impairment, and also it's not validated against the normal physician exam, ophthalmologist, optometrist exam, but this is like the best way you can do.
Okay, so just a quick follow-up. In 2014, we also are going to have a hearing supplement in the Health Interview Survey. And the question is there any way to enhance these questions for the vision supplement? Because I've looked at them and they seem to me like if I were wanting to have a go at it, maybe talking to some other professionals and coming up with ways to enhance the response, you know, what people are saying about the vision.
Yeah, actually it's like a pretty intensive question as we go with publishing paper. Like soon, John and CDC vision team is involved in it, and we're like doing evaluation of questions in like HS, in HANES, and trying to find out, you know, what is better to use and what kind of questions should be used in surveillance. Unfortunately, it's pretty difficult to rate visual impairment based on self-report, because whatever question you ask, even if you try to put some scale, some measure, it's still based on people's assumption and perception of their vision rather than like, you know, objective measurement. And considering that in HANES it's pretty expensive to keep this exam all the time. In 2008, NI removed the equipment, so now we have no idea when we will have like, you know, vision exam again. Back to it.
How actually, the
student
has
published a paper
within
HANES.
Yeah, I
have
seen.
Yeah, it's like one
reflective
about
paper.
Yeah.
Let me make a little pitch, and maybe we can chat about this, but we have a supplement to the American Journal of Ophthalmology with 8 papers that will be dealing with efforts to strengthen vision surveillance, and be happy to share that with you because, you know, there's at least 3 people in here who make a living trying to figure out what an adequate case definition is for vision impairment and how self-reported vision impairment is reflected in clinical measures. So, you know, those are all excellent questions, and some of them are being pursued, but this might be useful to help stimulate that. It seems to me that there needs to be a lot more synergy between the vision impaired and the hearing loss community, and because there's a lot of commonality, and then there's that small population that have both vision loss and hearing loss, and we need to pay attention to that group because they're clearly at risk in multiple ways. Shinji?
Then we will work out on questions, and then the most important question is funding. whether NII can provide funding for it.
So NII haven't decided yet.
Haven't been decided yet.
Okay, Michael?
If you have any ideas for better questions, just email them to me.
I have a question for Dr. Stolba and then a comment. But the question is, the decrease in the reported use of adaptive devices could be based on the question and the way the question was asked, because many people, you know, from 2008 to 2010, there's been adaptions made to things like iPads and stuff like that. So what we would have considered to be an adaptive device back in 2008 is now embedded in a lot of current consumer electronics technologies. And people are using that, but they're not calling it an assistive device because it's part of the instrument.
I guess we'll call them like stopping, you know, devices.
Right, because you can take an iPad and expand it and zoom it. We used to call that a low vision device at some point, you know, almost. So, you know, I just thought I'd mention that. So
yeah, we will probably like change questions the same as we did for like screen time. Before we asked only like video games and TV, and now we ask about computer time,
right.
We ask about video games, about iPads and all these devices.
Right.
So I guess when technology is changing, we have to keep up and ask questions. So
maybe,
you sort of
you
see
can add
the changes.
A 3D question in there. That would have been a few 3D.
And
one
other question. Yes, I just think that the question is actually pretty much not very
there. Right.
So we probably need to think about...
Yeah.
Yeah, issue with changing question is like, well, we
can't
make time.
I know.
So there will be like no trend. And that is why every time we're sort of like trying to wait for the better to keep our baseline, you
right.
also to have some point to refer or to start like with completely new like baseline.
Yeah, but I think your trend is showing that it's reduced, but it's actually increased. I think there's more people using adaptive devices. They just don't call it that. But then I had another comment on the other two speakers that really tie this together, because in terms of the numbers of federally qualified health centers with on-site eye care, we looked at UDS data from HRSA in 2010 and 2011, and nationwide there's only 140 FTE optometrists serving the nation's community health center system.
And out of how many?
140.
No, I mean how many centers? How many community health centers?
About 1,200 to 1,300 centers.
Wow.
8,000 sites.
Wow.
That now serve 23 million people. And again, 8 million of them are children that don't have any access to eye care. So in terms of comparison, there's about 3,000 FTE dentists. And we know that the dental to population ratio, FTE dentist to population FTE optometrist, is about the same. 1 to about 7,000 is pretty ideal. And so if you look at that, then there's about somewhere in the neighborhood of about 2,700 jobs out there for optometrists at federally qualified health centers that are needed right now just to barely meet the demand. So hopefully, you know, what Mort was saying, and I want to thank Mort, because this guy works all the time on this issue, and I served with him on a workforce study that AOA is doing, and, you know, he's great on that, and I appreciate your effort on that. So I just want to mention that it all relates, and so thanks for everybody's efforts on that.
Let me get to Kira first.
Yeah, I'll follow up. In your data, did you look at the fallout rate of individuals referred from the FQHC? Those actually showed. What was the data? The
no-show rate from FQHC is higher than from Perry Health Centers. No-show data from federally qualified health centers is higher than the other, from the people who come into the program or who are referred from community centers. We varied. It's Vision of Hope is a grant-funded program. Our work model has varied greatly through the years. We used to have a number of personnel who directly worked with the patients, spoke to them on the phone, and when we were doing that, we had our no-show rate in the teens, which we're so proud of, and then without that, you know, we're back up. But the we thought some of the problems from federally qualified health centers is that it comes from a doctor or a nurse, and often diabetics being referred who don't have complaint of vision, whereas the people who have the complaint of vision, the symptoms, they are more likely to come.
Yes.
I just like to ask if you know, because I don't know, whether hearing services are provided to these federally qualified health centers. Any of them. I've never heard of this.
Well, you know, they have to provide enabling services. Okay, so if somebody's hearing impaired, then that's one of the advantages of hearing care at a health center, because the enabling services act includes language. It includes assistance with sign language if it's needed. So in that case, they do offer the enabling services for the deaf and hearing impaired. But whether they actually offer treatment services, I don't believe so, because what they have to do, the thing that they're rated on is based on Section 330 of the Public Health Service Act, and it's the minimum amount of stuff. So that's why we have such a hard time getting them to provide eye care, because the only thing they have to congressionally do is do a vision screening with an eye chart, and they've checked off that they have so I'm sure it's the same thing there. If it's anything, it's pretty minimal.
And I don't know if this audience is aware, the other thing I want to bring out is that hearing impairment is also associated with diabetes. We publish based on the
What I love about a room like this is you can raise about any question and get an answer, and there's a lot of intellectual muscle and history here. What I would suggest, you know, those of us who've been in vision work lament the kind of the orphan nature of vision, but I think people with hearing loss, have the same set of problems, and it's orphaned and in part by the nature of the disability and the lack of capacity of systems to respond to that. So I think people tend to fall through. Just as a personal note, I had one of my staff who liked to teach me object lessons. Had a client who was deaf and blind, and she had learned to do all the finger spelling and all that to communicate with him. And so she made the point of introducing me to him, and then she left. And so I had no way of communicating with him, and the only sign I knew was, I love you, and I figured I could only say that to him once. So we were both kind of silent in that. But what was interesting to me was how inadequate I felt, because I think of myself as being a professional and reasonably competent, but here I was in a situation where I had no capacity at all. So, kind of interesting setting. Other questions? Yes. Shinchi?
I also have a comment for this issue. As somebody from the National Institute of Minority Health Disparities, I would really encourage you to have some further analysis for the minority group, at least for non-Hispanic, Black, and Hispanic. I know for the other group, Asian, we hope it happens enough for the draft appropriation and the plan appropriation.
I want to make a comment about Asel's presentation, and that is that if, since I come out of the blind rehab piece of all of this, you know, the reality in this country is that we don't have a robust vision rehabilitation program. There's no system, and so there's an occasional link between eye care providers and vision rehabilitation, and that's just in those communities where those services, you know, are just fortunate enough to have something available. So part of the lack of the uptake in those vision rehab services is that they aren't available. And so it's not need. The need exists, but the resources aren't available. So, you know, I think that I'm absolutely delighted that those questions are in that supplement. I think that's really important, but it really mirrors the lack of available services in vision rehab in this country. Okay, well, we're near the end of the point. What I want to say, you know, it makes me so happy, maybe it's just my age, but to see young people who are poised and prepared and smart. You know, when I was your age, I could not have gotten up here and done that. So I just want to congratulate you and commend you for that. And for joining me in thanking all of our presenters today.